Hello, you're watching Insider Live. My name is Senya Turkova. This is American Accent. As always, we're explaining what's happening in America with political scientist and American studies expert Yan Veselov. Yan, hello. Hello, Senya. Hello to everyone watching and listening. So, did you find your name in Epstein's files?
I looked for it out of curiosity, but fortunately or unfortunately, I didn't find it, although many people did.
Yes, we'll talk about it today, but it's a popular joke. I recently noticed on social media that people are writing, "I'm probably the only one who's not in Epstein's files." Even TV host Stephen Colbert joked about it, saying that Phil the Groundhog is probably the only famous man, a male, who wasn't on that list. Although many were seriously angry at the Groundhog, they wouldn't mind discrediting him somehow, since Phil, as you probably know, predicted 6 more weeks of winter on Groundhog Day, February 2nd. And after that, he became the subject of numerous memes. I know our viewers love it when we start an episode with memes. They've been writing to us about it. There you have it, these memes are full of everything. And Phil is supposedly deported after his prediction because it was discovered he's actually from Canada. Or Phil's in jail, whiling away his time playing cards. Or an angry mob is chasing Phil. They should arrest him for making such an unpleasant prediction. The weather really does remain unpleasant in Washington. People are making snowmen, literally out of snow bricks, because the snow is not fluffy at all and is downright unpleasant. And the roads, generally speaking, haven't been cleared, but I'll stop complaining about that. Let's really get to grips with the new batch of Epstein files. What we know, what we don't know. And the main topic of today's episode, how does Russia figure into these files? What Russian names are there? Ah, we found them all. We'll talk about that. Well, let's start with what was actually published this time. The US Department of Justice has released the largest archive on the Epstein case. 3 million pages, as well as 180,000 photographs and 2,000 videos, collected during the investigation of criminal cases related to Epstein and his accomplice, Ghislaine Maxwell. And perhaps this batch will be the last. The Department of Justice reports that no new publications are planned. Of course, this entire corpus needs to be studied, because so far as I understand, journalists have simply found some names through searches. It's impossible to study such a volume in a short time, but in the near future, I think we'll learn more and more as we read. Without getting into the Russian connection, what have we learned from this batch of files?
Yes, you're right that understanding and sorting through these files is quite difficult. Because of the way the Justice Department decided to release these files, they were simply released in their raw form, without any explanation whatsoever. Essentially, the only thing left to do with this entire collection is use a rudimentary search engine, highlighting individual words and mentions in the files, which, of course, really hinders any more thorough and comprehensive work with these files. BID has already been criticized for this, but the problem remains. Plus, as we recall, the files themselves were supposed to be released back in late December of last year, when Congress demanded it. Well, the White House delayed the release. One of the reasons given for the delay was that these files needed to be reviewed, to prevent any leaks of personal information about Epstein's victims. And overall, this is a fairly clear justification, but journalists immediately noted that in at least 40 cases, the names or some personal information of the victim were shared, yet they were nonetheless listed in these documents, meaning they weren't hidden. And again, the same situation repeated itself, as with the previous publication, where some files would appear, then be deleted, then reappear in a redacted form. This again suggests that the Ministry of Justice itself failed to properly handle these files.
As far as I understand, some victims have already written to the Ministry of Justice, claiming they found their full personal information, including their first and last names, there.
Yes, There was a whole series of statements from victims and their lawyers, who demanded that certain files be removed from publication so they could be redacted. This was done, but nevertheless, the fact that they appeared in this form is significant, even though it would seem there was time to sort through these files, review them, and edit them properly. Plus, it's worth remembering that a large number of files were ultimately never published. Again, Minius says that either they contain obscene images, or they are documents related to victims, or this could somehow impact the ongoing investigation. Although, again, the real question here is whether there is actually an ongoing investigation into Epstein's possible accomplices or not. We remember that at the time of the last publication of the files, there was correspondence between the prosecutor and him, in which they said they intended to indict a number of Epstein's accomplices. This time, there was even a diagram with Jeffrey Epstein at the center, surrounded by several people believed to be his accomplices. Some of them are directly identified, with their names and images. Some, on the contrary, are hidden. So, of course, an investigation is potentially possible, but moving on to the fact that in this latest batch of files, basically, it's mostly the same people. Donald Trump is there, and, in particular, there are numerous anonymous complaints about Donald Trump that were received by the FBI hotline in the 2010s. And there, Trump is, well, actually, accused of some truly incredible crimes of rape, of underage girls and boys. There are allegations of ritual sacrifices and children being buried on his golf courses. Well, in fact, this sounds more like, well, more like slander, essentially, because it's not substantiated. Again, the documents don't say whether any investigations were conducted, but it's worth assuming that such reports from anonymous sources are, of course, often unreliable. Besides that, of course.
Well, it's worth noting that you already said there's a lot of raw material, yes, unprocessed, and they even included a disclaimer saying it was a hotline appeal, and many of it hasn't been verified. And right off the bat, that actually corresponds to reality, because, admittedly, many of these messages are simply calls or letters, as you already said, to the hotline. But this disclaimer, on the part of the authorities, on the part of those publishing the files, in a certain way also shapes public opinion, like, is this even worth trusting? Maybe it's all some kind of fabrication. Who came up with all this? So, this kind of preface, as it were, to this, helps, I think, shape public opinion in a certain way. But it's true that we need to delve into this in detail and, in this pile of materials, really a pile, find what corresponds to reality. Well, this is a problem we're addressing, which we discussed during the previous publication of some of the files, that yes, all the files are uploaded in their raw form, then people start selecting specific files, actively discussing them, sharing them on social media, and then the Justice Department decides that it needs to issue a statement regarding individual files, try to clarify them somehow, provide some context. But it's clear that in the vast majority of cases, such disclaimers only appear for files associated with Donald Trump. That is, if there's a discussion of files related to Bill Clinton, who is actively mentioned there, Elon Musk, and other politicians, businessmen, cultural and scientific figures, their role and context, yes, the files in which their names are mentioned, the White House usually doesn't clarify. Because, well, because it doesn't see any need to, doesn't see any, reputational threat to itself. And this, of course, is the problem. The White House's narrative is somewhat partial, and the public has no idea what the true trajectory of this criminal case was, what really happened, because everything is just sitting there in its rather raw form. Yes. And here, well, I'll, make a judgment call. Well, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think there's a certain amount of irresponsibility in this. They dump everything out there and then ask journalists and ordinary people to sort it out themselves. Much of this hasn't been verified. As you already said, the work that should have been done hasn't been done. And, accordingly, in this wave, either manipulations arise, like some kind of implausible horror movie, or, conversely, people say, we don't believe this, because it's all completely unverified information and God knows what. Well, by the way, if we're talking about the names that appeared there, you say that the same old ones are still around. But the new thing, I think, is Bill Gates. Yes, Bill Gates is mentioned there too. Although, generally speaking, it was known that Bill Gates and Epstein knew each other. But there is, for example, one letter in which Epstein says that Bill Gates could have contracted some kind of venereal disease from one of the women he, could have met at those very parties that Lapstein organized. There. And this in this letter, of course, were very actively discussed afterwards. Plus, again, I mentioned Elon Musk. There are some pretty funny correspondences with Elon Musk there too. In one of the letters, Elon Musk persistently asks Epstein to a party, and in one of the letters, he writes literally in the morning, Christmas morning. So, it would seem, yes, people usually have something to do on this day. Elon Musk asked Epstein how to get into his party. In another email, Epstein told Musk that the UN General Assembly was coming up soon. We're having a party with very interesting people, to which Musk, apparently not getting the hint, wrote, well, I'm a serious businessman, I'm not really interested in meeting diplomats. To which Epstein replied, well, do you think I'm stupid? I meant it was a party with very young women, all of whom would be under 25. Well, regarding who asked whom at the meeting, let's now move on to the Russian connection, I suppose. And there are several names in this array of information. Well, firstly, Russia is mentioned several thousand times. And Putin's name appears in more than 1,000 files from Epstein's new batch of files. And there are fragments of correspondence with various people. Epstein discusses a potential meeting with Putin. But I want to meet here, they're here, let's reschedule. Basically, there are these attempts to meet with Putin and discuss certain details, whether the conditions are suitable or not. There's no evidence in the archive that Epstein actually met with Putin. However, it does contain a 2017 FBI report citing a source who claimed Epstein was allegedly involved in managing Putin's shadow assets. The British Daily Mail also wrote a detailed article about Epstein allegedly being Putin's treasurer. But in reality, the nature of the correspondence, at least the one we see in the published archive, doesn't indicate this. Well, that's just it, if you look at it with the naked eye, because it's unclear whether they met or not. If he really was in charge of Putin's finances, then perhaps the conversations would have been conducted differently.
Yes, I think so too, and I think it's important to clarify two points here. Firstly, if someone's name is mentioned in the Epstein files, it doesn't necessarily mean that person had any contact with Epstein himself, because the correspondence is full of, say, links to news stories, where the link itself might include a name. Plusson is very active.
Yes, there are just some articles, sometimes publications.
Plus, Epstein actively discussed politics with his various interlocutors, including Russia. For example, yes, he mentioned Ilya Panomarev, saying that he could possibly become the president of Russia. That's the first point. The second point, it seems to me, if we look at Epstein's communications in general in the context, it seems to me, or at least, I got the impression, that he's a man who, often tries to impress people and appear to be someone he's not. That is, he constantly inflates his importance, shows that he's much richer, that he's much more influential, that he knows a lot of people. That said, of course, he did know a lot of people. Yes, Bill Clinton and Bill Gates. So all these people really knew him and interacted with him. but it was very important to Epstein to maintain this reputation as a very influential person, someone with extensive connections and the ability to introduce you to anyone. And, in part, this is how he made his fortune.
Well, you could say that if it weren't for the criminal element, he might be like a hero from a picaresque novel. Yes, absolutely. But the sexual aspect, the aspect of sexual crimes, I think it doesn't contradict it, but rather complements it. Especially in the sense that this helped Epstein, among other things, meet people and form much stronger social bonds with them than through simple acquaintance. Again, there's this potential blackmail story here, although it's still quite unclear. Was Epstein trying to blackmail anyone with these sexual relationships or not? And it seems to me that this story about Epstein being Vladimir Putin's secret treasurer, it seems to me that Epstein was somehow trying to boost his own profile by telling people, oh, I have these connections, that I do this and that. Although, in fact, it's entirely possible that he never met Vladimir Putin himself or maintained any ties with him. And you mentioned Ilya Ponomarev. I think it's interesting to dwell on this in more detail, on his mention, because, the way he's mentioned in this archive, in general, can tell us a lot about the level of perception of Russia in certain circles in America. What am I talking about? Boris Nikolich is a venture capitalist, a former advisor to Bill Gates, the executor of Epstein's will in January 2012, and you remember that, this was the period of mass protests in Russia, Bolotnaya Square. M writes to the Financier about the political activities of Ilya Ponomarev, who was then a State Duma deputy. And Nikolich calls Ponomarev the main organizer of the Bolotnaya Square protests and the man, as you already said, who could replace Putin. And Nikolich convinces Epstein that Ponomarev will sooner or later become president of Russia, unless, quote, unless he is killed. But in reality, despite Ilya Ponomarev's serious opposition activities, and we know he was the only State Duma deputy to vote against the annexation of Crimea, and despite his certain accomplishments, well, he couldn't be called someone who was about to overthrow Putin and become president. We understand this perfectly well, but that's an exaggeration, to put it mildly, and could anyone even call such a person in Russia at that time? And it certainly wasn't Ilya Ponomarev, with all due respect. So, I think this point also highlights the level of perceptions about Russia, that he's still, and still is, in some ways, a bit of a dark horse. In short, people don't understand Russia, I mean, they don't understand what's going on. Yes, I think this is a really good example, not so much about Russia, but in general, as it applies to Epstein and many of his interlocutors. Although, on the one hand, it paints this image of some kind of Illuminati, yes, who secretly rule the world, yes, and pull the strings. But in reality, if you look again at many of these correspondences, and issues of politics and economics are often discussed at a truly primitive, almost kitchen table level. This is also a good window into how even influential people often discuss many things without really understanding them. Let's return to the names. Putin, Ilya Ponomarev, Sergei Lavrov. Lavrov's name pops up in Epstein's files at least 142 times, in internal correspondence, in notes, in reports from his circle. There's discussion of pretty girls from Moldova, possible meetings with Lavrov, and contacts with the former head of the Slovakian Foreign Ministry, Miro Lajic, who wrote that he spent 3 hours with Lavrov and ended the conversation with a cigar. There's also mention of a gift from Vitaly Churkin and a photo of him with Lavrov. Oh, and there are also several fragments mentioning Sergei Lavrov, which, again, as we've already said, paints a picture of Epstein's dense network of informal contacts. Again, we don't know how deep these contacts were, with high-ranking Russian diplomats. That is, there were some contacts. Also mentioned, in the archive, in this portion that was just published, are Russian businessmen Vladislav Doronin and Umar Jabrailov, and Masha Drakova. Masha Drakova is a former NASHI member, commissioner, and press secretary of the NASH movement. Oh, and she, well, it was already known that independent publications had written about this in their investigations, claiming that she was involved in Epstein's PR. Well, some new details have surfaced here, too.
Yes, she, among other things, suggests how, after Epstein's first criminal case, which happened in the 2000s, to clear his image or something, she suggested he make some kind of documentary about him, launch an Epstein Prize, similar to the Nobel Prize, and open some kind of NGO that would address issues of violence against women. Well, those are classic examples, basically, of how someone who's found themselves in such a scandal, well, not just scandalous, but, well, a criminal story, wants to somehow clear their image. So, they discussed that, among other things. And then, at some point, Epstein actually asked her for intimate photos. As far as I understand, that's where their communication ended. In short, it wasn't possible to flesh out the image. Incidentally, Vitaly Churkin also mentioned this to the Russian Federation's representative to the UN. Epstein also corresponded with him in 2016. Among other things, Epstein's letters indicate that he helped secure a job for Churkin's son, Maxim, at one of his companies and, in general, promoted him in some way.
Well, an anti-harassment foundation named after Epstein certainly sounds a bit much, and...
Yes, it would have been incredibly simple.
Well, as we know, that idea failed to materialize. And what else is there about Russia? Epstein's correspondence from 2018 mentions the Krasnodar modeling agency Storm and one of its models, Raya. However, the agency's founder has already stated that she has no connection with Epstein and has never sent anyone to work for him. Epstein's interest in Eastern European women is also evidenced by his correspondence with Steve Tisci, co-owner of the New York Giants American football team. And in 2013, they discussed Ukrainian and Russian women Tisci met through Epstein. So, there are a lot of references at various levels, as you can see, from Putin to some modeling agencies or people like Masha Drakova, who, by the way, let me remind you, at some point moved to America, founded a venture capital company, and is also connected to Silicon Valley. So, there's such a wide circle of contacts at various levels. And we don't yet know what this means. Some of these correspondences may be insignificant, while others may be, and there's some hidden agenda there, and that needs to be sorted out. But all of this again has given rise to conspiracy theories, and maybe not conspiracy theories, again, we don't know. But all of this has given grounds for many to speculate that Steen was perhaps an agent of Moscow. Well, again, this comes back to the problem of the files being released in such a raw state. You'd think they should have clarified everything for us, put everything in its place, and made everything clear to us. In the end, on the contrary, it only created more conspiracy theories, because anyone can find any of the files, read them, and, based on a few emails, draw their own conclusions about what's going on, deciding that Epstein, I don't know, was a cannibal, that Epstein was an agent of MASSID, or, for example, that Epstein is an agent of the Russian Secret Services. Again, by the way, in Russia they say he's an agent of MASSID, they say we have nothing to do with it. This is all British propaganda from the Daily Mail, but in reality, of course, he is an agent of MASSID.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if in Israel they say he's an FSB agent, probably, because for them, too, it probably isn't very pleasant to hear. That's it. And because the White House seems to be refusing to, recreate a narrative about the Epstein files, how they should be read, how they should be treated, let alone actually publish them properly, yes, with certain sections, a chronology, so that everything can be perceived in some kind of systemic context. Because of this, naturally, everyone is starting to discuss a few letters, excerpts from letters, and, basically, draw some really big conclusions from them. Although, of course, in general, there are certain hints of connections with Russian intelligence services. That's because there are also correspondence between Epstein and Sergei Pelyakov. He is a graduate of the FSB Academy, who twice helped Epstein obtain visas to the Russian Federation. And Epstein has been to Russia, well, at least several times, in different cities. That's why there are some definite hints. But again, it's difficult to say that Epstein was, well, a full-fledged agent of the Russian intelligence services, or even of the Israeli intelligence services. It's clear that the intelligence services often try to develop such influential people and, of course, are always happy if they become their sources, although not necessarily those sources who realize they're actually sharing information with the intelligence services. They may often be unaware of this, and for the intelligence services, again, this is also very important. Therefore, it's entirely possible that representatives of various intelligence agencies tried to contact Epstein and recruit him as their informant, but whether he ultimately was one, based on these letters, is unclear to us.
We decided to address this question to David Satter, an American journalist, Russia expert, and author of books in which he was the first to write about the FSB's role in the Moscow apartment bombings. David Satter is a former correspondent for the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal in the Russian capital. We discussed whether Epstein's network was a Kremlin kompromat trap. What do the mentions of Russia, Putin, and some other players in the latest batch of Epstein files mean to you? Right.
Now, we don't have complete information, only various hints. Yes. But the number of hints is rapidly increasing. And of course, we're all trying to understand the reason for Trump's behavior toward Russia. But he's a man who knows that when negotiating with someone, you still need to have the ability to simply use pressure on the other side, especially if the relations are more or less hostile. But he ignores this rule with regard to Russia. This is apparently the only exception. He's willing to use pressure against Iran. He's willing to use pressure against Venezuela. He's, yes, willing to use it against Hamas. But when it comes to Russia, he just can't seem to get to a situation where he's seriously using the very tools we have. The tools of pressure, I mean.
Right?
So it's a mystery, difficult to simply interpret, why he's doing this. And we have various hints. That Jeffrey Epstein, who organized a global network, of acquaintances, and that's
how you intelligently called a network of acquaintances.
Yes, acquaintances. Well, and sleep with, he supplied Russian girls and not only Russians, but others. And it all looks like, an intelligence operation. But the only country that would be strongly interested in this is Russia. And because it's Russia, which simply wants to destabilize American society. Well, people mention Israel, but Israel is not interested in creating chaos in America. On the contrary. And, apparently, one of the so-called clients of these women was former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. Therefore, it all seems somehow strange, suspicious. And why do you think this looks exactly like an intelligence operation? What exactly indicates this? Well, I find it hard to imagine that Ashen could have such sums at his disposal.
Yeah, he's
independent, but his sources and his prosperity aren't proportional, but rather to his lifestyle. Plus, there's the fact that he's apparently gotten involved everywhere. And doing this without highly qualified help would be difficult. And where did these girls come from, especially from Russia? We know well that Russian organized crime is the main supplier of suppliers, and of live goods, as they say in Russia. That's all. But it should be added that the picture is still incomplete. And we're only seeing very strange coincidences. For example, one of the tenants in Trump Tower was Yapinchik, Russia's leading gangster, sadist, and murderer. Well, people usually check who's going to live in their very expensive apartments. Didn't Rakto tell Trump's people who this Yapinchik was? Apparently not. Trump tries to somehow justify Putin in every situation. And even when Putin demonstratively treats him with maturity, despite how he treats his representatives, like Steve Utkov, and as I recall, Putin made Utkov wait for him for 8 hours. It's the same thing the gangsters in St. Petersburg did to Putin himself, when he was like no one else. And he was somewhat dependent on organized crime. Well, they made him wait. But now he understands this, he's making them wait for him. The Queen of England and the Pope of Rome.
These emails were published, leading many to speculate that Epstein could indeed have been an agent working for Moscow. So, from your point of view, this isn't just a conspiracy theory, it may have some basis. Well, that would be logical, of course, but while these messages contain various references, all this requires confirmation. And the picture is, of course, logical. The picture is simply that. Epstein was a close friend of Trump, and they had various contacts that were compromising with the Russians. Trump understands this and doesn't particularly want to offend someone who could seriously compromise him. That's the theory, at least. There's a certain logic to it, but it hasn't been proven yet. And we don't even know who even mentioned these emails. And what context were these emails in, if they were from truly informed people? Therefore, given the seriousness of all this, we must approach this with seriousness and caution. I can personally speak about such things with considerable experience, because I was the first in America to say that the steel was a fake.
Yeah.
That it was fake information collected by the FSB, which was passed on by a Democrat to undermine Trump. And it was absolutely true because it was their familiar language, their familiar techniques, and their familiar strategies. And finally, it was discovered that their sources were from Russia, from the FSB. Ah, but there's another possibility here that can't be ruled out, but I'm just saying this. I'm not simply asserting this as a fact, just as a possibility that hasn't yet been confirmed. Sometimes Russian intelligence creates a false narrative, compromising information, to hide the real thing. And this dosimetry was very easy. Well, it took several years for inexperienced Americans to figure it out. And, naturally, during this period, it created a lot of chaos in America and a lot of problems. But perhaps the situation wasn't exhausted with the dosimetry, that there could be something else. And perhaps dosimetry was even used to keep the real situation from becoming public. The world of Russian intelligence is a dark and very dangerous one, but it can still be said that these hints, these signs that we see in Epstein's emails and documents, they are right thinking, and, of course, they are, this whole situation is a thorough investigation. They say 3 million documents, but given the importance of this, it wasn't just about girls and not just about his sexual eccentricities with Epstein, although that, could be something more significant and impactful on world politics. And this will be the most serious investigation.
But in general, if we talk about sexual blackmail, how common is this practice for intelligence agencies?
Well, for Russia, it's typical. It's, well, sexual blackmail. This, and for everyone, by the way, not just Russian intelligence, because they've always had to blackmail someone on something. But in the case of communication, it's not just girls. They were minors.
Yes.
They were, so it was against the law, among other things. and girls in such a situation are excellent sources of information. Therefore, the situation, as they say, as they used to say in Russia, is clearly murky. And it is necessary, but I would somehow understand that the situation is suspicious. There's a lot that points to. Some kind of connection between Epstein, Russia, and Trump. It's not forged, but there were. And this requires a detailed investigation, because millions of people are dying in Ukraine right now. This will be a test of sorts for American society too. How well can we truly understand the dark, dark world, the dark forest of Russian intelligence and Russian practices? Let
me remind you, this is David Satter, an American journalist and Russia expert. And as you heard, he said this is all serious and needs to be thoroughly investigated. And this raises the question we already posed at the beginning of our program. Will they investigate? First, who's responsible for the publication? There's a certain conflict of interest there. Yes, there is certainly a conflict. It stems from the fact that Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche is responsible for the publication. And Blanche used to be Donald Trump's personal lawyer, who, in general, helped him handle his criminal cases. A lot of people have been talking about this, that there's, well, a very obvious conflict of interest. But the investigation is even less clear, because, well, we remember that last spring, the Trump administration for the first time refused to actually publish Epstein's files, stating that we'd looked at everything, we'd sorted it all out, and decided that, well, there was no reason to believe that any investigation was necessary. We decided that Epstein had no accomplices. He acted solely on his own, plus his accomplice, Gail Maxova, who is currently serving a 20-year prison sentence. And, by the way, she's scheduled to testify in Congress soon. That's also worth keeping an eye on. And, in fact, based on this, they refused to publish any files. We remember the wave of discontent that followed. A bill calling for publication was introduced in Congress, and Donald Trump, who initially opposed publication and even pressured his Republican colleagues to support the bill, ultimately changed his position and said, "Yes, let's publish it." And when Einstein's first letters began to be published, he demanded that the Attorney General, Pompondi, open an investigation, not against himself, of course, but against Bill Clinton, who appears in Einstein's letters, and against former Treasury Secretary Lavie Summers and others. The Attorney General's office stated that, yes, they had heard the president's team and were planning to conduct an investigation, but we don't know anything about the status of this investigation. We don't know whether anyone will be charged. And, well, how it will ultimately end. But then again, given that the Justice Department is publishing this latest batch of files, which it claims is the final one, it stated that some of them were not published because they could undermine the ongoing investigation. Based on this, we can assume that some kind of investigation is underway. But again, we don't yet know its status or its outcome. But Congress is also working on publishing and investigating the file's contents. I understand these are cross-partisan initiatives. Specifically, Republican Thomas Massie and Democrat Roana are leading this investigation and have initiated the Stein Files Transparency Act. Which has joined them. Yes, this story is still raging in Congress, because, well, Congress did achieve a victory by passing this bill. And, in general, it led to Donald Trump himself, who initially opposed it, eventually supporting it, sensing some reputational damage from this whole affair. But it seems to me that although the files, most of the files, have already been published, the story is clearly not over. Firstly, because many of these files have yet to be read, not taken into context, a truly systemic narrative based on these files still needs to be constructed. Plus, again, conspiracy theories, as I said, have only increased. And I think the public at large will continue to feel that something is missing, that something was certainly not published, that something was hidden. Again, given the Trump administration's constant back and forth about whether we'll reveal everything, then we won't reveal anything, then, okay, we'll reveal some of it. This naturally fuels mistrust that the Justice Department isn't acting as independent law enforcement, but is essentially acting as Donald Trump's lawyers, trying to shield him from information that could somehow discredit him. And then, by the way, what you said about this entire array of information being made public, and then everyone can find something they like in it, as they say, and draw their own conclusions, and in any direction. In other words, everyone can interpret it as they please, because no proper work has been done. And this is, in fact, a well-known example of such a propaganda tactic. This propaganda tactic exists. When something serious happens, propaganda throws out a huge number of theories so that, like in a store, everyone can choose the one that suits them best. These theories can be completely different, some of them can be completely outlandish, and some even contradict each other. No one cares, they're just thrown out. A classic example of this scenario is the Malaysian Boeing situation. We remember when Russian propaganda threw out an incredible number of theories, including the corpses already on the plane, and all sorts of other things. We know that. Oh, well, we know that the investigation has been conducted and everything has been established, basically, who did it. But nevertheless, back then, a huge number of theories were thrown out, and this disoriented people. Everyone chose what they wanted and drew their own conclusions, and this is what resulted in confusion and chaos. And now, basically, as we see, roughly the same thing is happening. Do you think more will be released, or is this really the last, as the Justice Department said? Well, I suspect that under the current administration, it's unlikely anything else will be released, although, according to the law passed by Congress, the Justice Department is required to compile a report and submit it to legislators, explaining why certain files were released while others weren't. That is, it's required to explain why a specific file was either heavily redacted or, well, not made public at all. And based on this report, I think Congress will continue to push forward with the Epstein files, perhaps trying to push for the release of individual files, but I doubt the Justice Department will be forthcoming with the legislature. Perhaps the next administration will make some additional publications. For example, let's take the files related to the Kennedy assassination. When the files were first published, not all of them were, and practically every administration discussed the need to publish everything. And I think David Satter said something important in our conversation. He said that this story isn't just, although that's very important, and it's very serious, about sexual crimes. The threads could extend further into geopolitics, and we might be able to see some connections, some contacts, and learn about some decisions that influenced, and perhaps continue to influence, events in the world. And this is very important, because we know that the war is ongoing and there are possible contacts of this kind between the American administration or Epstein and Putin, and all of this could shed light on what happened and what is happening, and, accordingly, could influence the course of events in a certain way. Yes, of course, because, after all, given Epstein's extensive connections not only with American politicians and businessmen but also with foreign ones, both politicians and businessmen, both the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and the Saudi royal family were mentioned in both the last and previous batch of public files. The latter actively discussed the Norwegian royal family. So, this network, essentially of connections and influence, which he tried to create around himself by hook or by crook, possibly blackmail, yes, by inciting people to illegal sexual acts with minors, and this global network of Jeffrey Epstein was undoubtedly influential. But again, the extent of its influence, I don't think we still understand, but I think we'll probably return to this topic more than once. We'll have more than one episode about this. Yes, absolutely. Because, again, as I said, I think Congress will continue to advance this topic. Plus, again, many Democrats feel like this is a winning issue for them. For some Republicans, it's simply a matter of principle. So there you have it. Plus, there will be testimony from Bill and Hillary Clinton. They finally agreed to testify before Congress. Let me remind you, they initially refused. And Congress began threatening to hold them in contempt. Now, they've finally agreed. Again, it will be interesting to see what they say, what they'll be asked, what both Republicans and Democrats will ask. That is, will the Democrats try to defend the former president and his wife, or will they rather, as they say in English, THR the bus, that is, throw them under the bus, yes, as if sacrificing their reputations, yes, yes, in order to demonstrate to voters that they have some kind of principled commitment to revealing the truth. So, of course, we will be watching this closely. At the end, as always, there's the traditional announcement. An insider has launched a VPN for government websites. It allows those living abroad to access websites within Russia. Mail, bailiffs, schools, as well as websites with movies and other content. Everything that may not be available in the country where you currently live. You can subscribe through the bot, the name of which you will find in the description of this video. And that concludes our broadcast. We turn to you again. Please send us your questions. We will be happy to answer them if we can. Oh, and suggest topics for our future programs. You've seen American Accent. See you next week. Bye-bye.